The Ozarks at Large podcast is made possible by KUAF's contributing listeners. Support from individual listeners in our community helps pay for the cost of producing and distributing this podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast and other digital media produced by KUAF, you can make a contribution at supportkuaf.com.
This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Later this afternoon on 91.3 on Here and Now, a preview of the highly anticipated film version of A Wrinkle in Time. Here and Now, today, from 1 until 3 on 91.3. This is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday afternoon, March 6th, 2018. I'm Kyle Kellums. A celebration of art and labor and how those two topics intertwine continues in Bentonville tonight. The Spring and Arts Culture Festival is based at Northwest Arkansas Community College. Tonight, it takes center stage at 21C Museum Hotel in downtown Bentonville. Purdy Eaton, an artist featured in the current exhibition at 21C, will deliver a talk about his work tonight at 6:30. The evening will also include a brief introduction to 21C Bentonville's newest exhibition, Labor and Materials, by 21C Assistant Curator Amethyst Ray Beaver. In about 15 minutes this afternoon, a new book offers educators advice for teaching their students to be savvy. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda talks to the author of Critical Media Literacy and Fake News in Post-Truth America. First this afternoon, the federal government is giving approval to Arkansas's plan to add a work requirement for some low-income residents to continue to receive health insurance through the state's version of Medicaid, called Arkansas Works. Jacob Kaufman, with our partner station KUAR in Little Rock, was at yesterday's announcement, and he has this report.
CMS Director Seema Verma personally hand-delivered the federal agency's letter to Governor Asa Hutchinson to grant the state's request.
It's my aim and the aim of this administration with President Trump and Secretary Azar to really change how CMS is working with states. We are committed to working with states and being true partners and helping them get to where they want to go.
It's been nearly a year since the governor first requested and the legislature backed the work requirement waiver. It'll impact some 70,000 Arkansans out of 268,000 or so enrolled through Medicaid expansion.
And this is good news for Arkansas because this is not about punishing anyone. It's about giving people an opportunity to work. It's to give them the training that they need. It's to help them to move out of poverty and up the economic ladder. That is the objective of it.
The Obama administration routinely denied work requirements, saying they were antithetical to the whole point of Medicaid, which is to make sure that poor people have access to health insurance. The Trump administration, though, has already granted Kentucky and Indiana a work requirement add-on, but Governor Hutchinson promises that Arkansas will be the first state to actually implement the new concept.
And that is because we're ready with our systems. This will be going fairly quickly, and we've got our processes down.
And it'll be carried out in two phases. The first group is for 30 to 49-year-olds. They'll first be notified March 15th of this year and will be required to begin work-related activities on June 1st if they want to keep Medicaid coverage. About 39,000 people don't meet current exemptions, though they might when they verify it with the state. Enrollees must obtain 80 hours of work a month in some combination of work, school, volunteering, job training, or job searching. CMS Director Verma says reasonable exemptions have been made.
People that have substance abuse disorder. There are exemptions for parents that perhaps are taking care of a child. And there's also some age exemptions as well. So I think they've done a really good job of thinking through some of the individuals that may or may not be able to participate in the workforce and in community engagement.
And then in 2019, another 30,000 enrollees, this time between the ages of 19 and 30, will face the same new restrictions on insurance coverage. While the governor and Director Verma believe the work requirement will get people to have gainful employment and move them to career training and to employer-based health care, hopefully, others like the American Lung Association and Marquita Little, the health policy director at Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, aren't so sure.
So it definitely is potentially punitive in nature should a person fail to meet the requirement or if they just fail to certify or confirm that they're exempt. And I think it's three times that they can miss that. And we know that as the systems become more complex, oftentimes that alone creates barriers. And so our concern is that someone who might even meet the exemption fails to confirm it, and they would potentially lose their coverage for the remainder of the year.
Federal approval of these new restrictions to the Affordable Care Act-enabled expansion of Medicaid comes at a time when Republicans in the Arkansas legislature are struggling to secure enough votes among their own caucus to reauthorize the program. Senate Majority Leader and next session's Senate President Jim Hendren, who happens to be a nephew of the governor's, says he doesn't know if these new restrictions will be enough to get conservative Republicans to support it this week.
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to get people to give me a straight answer, and people keep asking me, and I'm like, I can't get definite answers. I think it will help, and it will get us closer. But whether or not it's going to push us over the edge, we probably won't know until the vote is cast. So we need a little drama around here, right?
The legislature has to annually approve the State Department of Human Services budget, which includes Medicaid, with a 3/4 vote. Republicans control supermajorities in the State House and Senate, though the Senate has 3 vacancies, all Republicans, this fiscal session, one due to death, another due to resignation for criminal activity, and another member left to take a post in the Trump administration. And while the state got its work requirement waiver granted, CMS did not give the go-ahead on a second item proposed by the governor last year to reduce eligibility from those earning 138% of the federal poverty level down to 100%. Director Verma didn't officially deny that waiver request. It was more of a non-denial.
We're still working through some issues in that particular area, but we wanted to move forward on the community engagement and work requirement piece.
And that may be a sore spot for some conservative lawmakers hoping to hold out for that, but that's a bright spot for Marquita Little. It could have jeopardized insurance coverage for 60,000 Arkansans.
We know that these are some of the most vulnerable Arkansans and some of the families that are struggling the most at this income range. And our criticism of that policy was based on the fact that there's so much uncertainty happening at the federal level as it relates to the healthcare system that we just could not guarantee that the marketplace would offer a comparable, affordable coverage option for those people if they had been immediately, if they had become immediately ineligible for Arkansas work.
I'm Jacob Kaufman, KUAR News.
This is Ozarks at Large. A class of immigrants from China, Italy, Iran, South Korea, and Uzbekistan is learning English health literacy and food culture while tasting international cuisine they've prepared for a class at Ozark Literacy in Fayetteville. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich cooked up this report.
Two Ozark literacy students have brought freshly prepared dishes to taste today.
I'm Özge from Turkey, and I prepared red lentil balls. Yeah, we call it mercimekli köfte in Turkish.
With fresh lettuce wraps, Aja, who is 23, arrived in Northwest Arkansas last August and has learned conversational English in just 5 months. Giorchino, age 49, from Italy, is a visiting scholar at the University of Arkansas Division of Agriculture Economics.
I think it's a very good opportunity for me to learn, to improve my English skills. So the International Student and Scholars Office suggested me to come here.
Giorchino plans to bring authentic Italian cuisine to class in a few weeks.
My wife suggested we can prepare, so she can prepare the traditional Italian pizza, the so-called pizza margherita.
Arroyo is from Uzbekistan, her spouse employed at the U of A's agricultural division. She'll prepare traditional rice pilaf next week.
Before, I never study English. Nowadays, I can speak. Can speak.
Xiao Min presents traditional Chinese salad to the class, smashed cucumber, seasoned with garlic and sesame oil. She's written up the recipe, which the class reads and edits together on a digital whiteboard.
Using the side of the knife, smash the cucumbers and then cut them into small cubes.
Into small cubes. Do you want pieces or cubes?
Cubes.
Xiao Min, a physician and endocrinologist, has been here 6 months.
When I first came here, I think it is really difficult for me to understand what they're talking about. Yes, and during the half a year, I think I learned a lot, not only the language, but also the culture of American. The teacher tells us each week, tells us something interesting and the news during the week. And also teach us how to cook the different food, not only American food. And because the students, we are from a different country, and they bring different food and different country, I learn a lot.
Lisa Waldron, health literacy instructor, says the class course is comprehensive.
What we're doing is I'm asking every student to contribute a recipe from their country, and we have probably 8 to 10 different countries represented in this class, and every week a student will present their recipe. We are peer editing that, and they'll also bring the dish that they've prepared the night before from home, and we all get to taste it. And so they learn reading and writing, editing skills, and also just gain confidence in their presentation skills. And we all have fun eating it together. And already the students are making one another's recipes.
Manners are also taught, given eating traditions vary from country to country.
But we're also looking at other healthy habits, like how to manage stress, what to do if you're feeling culture shock, sleep routines, interaction with coworkers, and how to just have positive relationships.
Class recipes, Waldron says, along with chef bios and food stories, will be posted on Ozark Literacy's website later this year for the world to consume. Patty Sullivan also sampled the lentil and cucumber salad. She's executive director of Ozark Literacy Council, established in 1964, headquartered on Sunbridge Avenue in central Fayetteville, conveniently off the Razorback Greenway. Lots of students cycle to class.
In 2017, we had 370 students from 54 countries in our program. Some of them are here in classes. About 95% of our students are students who are acquiring English as a second or a third language. Literacy levels are from very beginning literacy in any language to some of our students are very literate and professionals in and are living here and learning the language so they can access employment and be part of the community.
These free literacy classes range from basic and beginning life skills, pronunciation, listening, speaking, reading, and writing, to intermediate and advanced courses in conversational English, current events, geography, and culture. Sullivan says classes take field trips, for example, to Crystal Bridges Art Museum, bring in law enforcement to discuss safety issues, and legal experts to learn how to negotiate with landlords. And they also learn job skills.
And we also connect our students to citizenship. We help them with driver's license tests. There are a lot of components to working in our region. And so formally and informally, we navigate them to perhaps to the GED program offered through Fayetteville Adult Education. NTI and NWAC both offer adult education programs as well that we work with them all the time.
All on $250,000 budget annually. Sullivan says enrollment has ballooned in recent years given an influx of international immigrants as well as political refugees to the region. Support is provided by the Arkansas Literacy Council and Arkansas Adult Education corporate sponsors and donations and from the community. Mina Phoebus is program director for Ozark Literacy Council. She's originally from South Korea, where she obtained a master's degree in English education. She coordinates 100 volunteer tutors and teachers, including 4 from AmeriCorps who teach morning, afternoon, and evening classes.
All classes are conducted in English, but when they are out in the lobby, they can communicate in their language. And also afternoon between 12 to 5, so many advanced students are kind of internally trained to how to help others. So they have Chinese classes going on. So advanced student is teaching lower level too, and all different levels going on. So basically we utilize 8:30 through 8 p.m., Monday through Thursday,
Back in the health literacy classroom, we meet one more student who frames how well Ozark literacy works. By the way, she prepared a traditional South Korean sweet potato noodle dish last week.
Hi, my name is Yoon Jung Cho. I'm 27 years old. I'm from South Korea. My husband works at U of A as a researcher. I've been studying for more than 6 months. And when I came here, I can't listen or understanding in English. But nowadays, I can.
Thanks to Ozark Literacy Council. In the coming weeks, we'll get to meet more folks from OLC to learn how they are succeeding. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
You can find out more at ozarkliteracy.org. And there is more literacy just ahead. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda recently sat down with Chris Gehring about the book he co-edited, Critical Media Literacy and Fake News in Post-Truth America.
What I was doing as a high school teacher in the early 2000s in Kansas, and a lot of what I've done since then is really pretty squarely media literacy. And so I, you know, am continuing to like learn and expand and grow as a scholar and as a thinker. And so as I'm doing those things, critical media literacy really makes so much sense because it really, it's like media literacy with, you know, taking in specifically into account race, gender, and class.
That conversation is just ahead on this Tuesday edition of Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The city of Eureka Springs offers a variety of happily ever after wedding options from the traditional to the intimate held in historic hotels, Victorian parlors, and one of many floral springs. In Eureka Springs, ceremonies are available anywhere at any time. More information at eurekasprings.org.
And this reminder, if you want to find out more about all the programs that we have on 91.3, as well as our classical music station KUAF2 and our mostly jazz station KUAF3, schedules are available at KUAF.com. Critical Media Literacy and Fake News in Post-Truth America is a new book that offers educators advice for teaching their students to be media savvy. The book is part of the Critical Media Literacy series from publisher Brill Sense. Chris Gehring, an associate professor of English education at the University of Arkansas, co-edited the new book. In the publication's introduction, the editors say this project is not so much a response to the 2016 presidential election as a response to the issues highlighted through that event and misinformation campaigns associated with it. Chris Gehring recently stopped by Studio 123 to speak with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda about his new project.
There are differences between media literacy and critical media literacy, other than just the name. but, you know, what I was doing as a high school teacher in the early 2000s in Kansas, and a lot of what I've done since then is really pretty squarely media literacy. And so I, you know, am continuing to like learn and expand and grow as a scholar and as a thinker. And so as I'm doing those things, critical media literacy really makes so much sense because it really, it's like media literacy with, you know, taking in specifically into account race, gender, and class. And so, you know, I feel like anything that I can do to stand up for and battle for those underrepresented or misrepresented parts of our society, I'm going to try to do that. So
what is the difference between media literacy and critical media literacy?
Yeah, I think media literacy, you know, so I'll give you like a for example. So as a high school teacher, I took the backs of Rolling Stone magazines and asked my students to read those advertisements. And so, you know, that's like the prime spot for advertising is the back of a magazine because someone's going to stand up and be reading it. And so anybody around is going to see that. Well, we really tried to figure out in that advertising analysis, you know, what who is the target audience for this? You know, what are the ways that the advertisers are making meaning? You know, we we just come to recognize that there are millions and millions of dollars that go into that sort of thing, I think is like a really important just sort of revelation for high school kids to have. And, what the students ultimately came up with was that most of the cigarette and alcohol advertising on the backs of Rolling Stone magazines were directed primarily at them. And even though they weren't legally of an age to buy those things, there was like this Camel cigarettes had an advertisement, and there were like all kinds of different flavored cigarettes, and they look like candy cigarettes. And I'm like, well, who are they? who is this targeted towards? And the class just like universally says, this is towards us. This is for us. This is interesting to us. And I think, I don't know too many 35-year-olds or 40-year-olds that are like, ooh, I would like to have a candy cigarette right now. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I don't smoke or hang around a lot of people who smoke, but maybe they do that. But so I think that's, kind of the traditional media literacy, which I think is terrific and I think we need more of. And I'm not suggesting at all that, that critical media literacy is better. But I think moving students towards acting on their worlds has to come with an acknowledgement that there are huge portions of our society that are underrepresented or misrepresented. And I think that if you can start looking at things like advertisements or like Facebook ads or memes, et cetera, and looking at those through this sense of critical media literacy and identifying, gender, identifying class, identifying race and markers of those things, and how those different folks are represented or misrepresented. I think that's an important thing to moving us forward, because I feel like, when we many times the media does target or play on stereotypes or tropes of different, sects of our society, and I find that to be, unfortunate, but also reality.
So using those critical thinking skills when ingesting different types of media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and critical critical also in the sense of kind of critical consciousness. So work that's sort of going to move forward from like Paulo Freire and others. So, I think that acting on the world is so important, and getting students as soon as possible to start seeing that they're not, it's not just an isolated existence that they're living, with a lot of other people, and their existence might be perfectly fine. But the reality is that there are a lot of people in our country that aren't perfectly fine and need those of us in positions of privilege to stand up and say something.
How is the book structured?
Yeah, so we've got an introductory chapter, which I co-wrote with my co-editor, Paul Thomas. And then Paul actually writes sort of a foundational chapter after that. And then we hit one after another with different, different takes on critical media literacy from around the country. It is a United States audience collection of contributors. So it doesn't necessarily have to be, but that's just where we got people from. So I tried to really balance, the different looks at things. And so if you're reading through this book, you would see, here's a group of, here's a couple of ninth grade teachers in Michigan. Here's what they're doing. Here's the advice of a college professor who's teaching, composition classes, and how she's changed or shifted her curriculum in the last just a little bit to address some of these issues. And so, and I think that it's one of the interesting things about the collection is that sometimes the advice of authors of separate chapters is sort of conflicting. So some of the writers here suggest things like acronyms that students or adults can remember to sort of like try to evaluate the media. And I actually brought one of those with me to talk about today. And others actually suggested, no, that's never going to be good enough. If we do those things, as soon as we do one of those things, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be outdated and outmoded. And I think, you know, I think this is such an interesting time. I mean, just let me say this a million times. This is such an interesting time that we're living in terms of all of these things. And interesting can have a lot of different connotations. And one of them is that I think it's a dangerous time. I think that there are real and present dangers with all of this and this kind of notion of post-truth, this notion of labeling everything fake news that we might disagree with. This is not a democracy functioning as a democracy. So I feel like that, you know, to get back to that, we're really going to need to do some work. And this is not, let me say this, it's not a problem where this is not a situation that was created by the students in the schools, right? So this book is directed towards teachers. This is not like a book that's blaming the school system for not doing enough media literacy or, we're not taking the position that schools are to blame or the kids are to blame. There's plenty of blame to go around. Let's see what we can do about it and kind of in our own individual spheres of influence. I think that's a really important part, that anybody could take part in. And so that's what we're trying to do with this book ultimately is to have a little bit of do a little bit of good. But it's not a book written because, you know, the kids aren't as smart as they were 5 years ago. You know, the kids today are reading and writing in different ways more than any one in human history. And the reality is, the way that we're doing, the way that they're doing things often looks very different from the way that school does things and looks even different yet from the way things are tested, et cetera. So I'm not suggesting a media literacy test is going to be the answer here because while I think that would be interesting to see the results of, the idea that a test is going to fix any kind of situation in school is sort of preposterous in my humble opinion.
What are one of those acronyms that you mentioned?
Yeah, so my colleagues Troy Hicks and Kristen Holly Turner had a new book come out a year ago, and it's about argument, so it's not directly tied to this, but they were writing in our book about kind of the connections of evidence and how hard it is to evaluate evidence today, and sort of as a if you don't mind, as a precursor to sort of sharing that acronym with you, I wanted to share a quote from that's in their chapter from the great philosopher of NPR, Ira Glass. So the presentation of facts is seen as a partisan opinion, and then every day a barrage of untruths are presented as truth, and we're just supposed to suck it up. That's the moment we live in. That's our country right now. And this is going to continue after this election, no matter who wins. Like, this is the rest of our lives, I think, this post-truth politics. With so many of us getting our news from social media and from sources that we agree with, it's easier than ever to check if a fact is true, and facts matter less than ever. And so that was Ira before the 2016 election. And I think, I think that's really kind of the framework we're working from now. Like it, hate it, love it, whatever. I believe that things, as broadly as we can sort of conceive of that, have to change in recognition that this is we're in a different place than we were just a few years ago. So, to Troy and Kristen's acronym here is MINDFUL, and so how to be mindful readers and writers of social media. M stands for monitor your reading and writing. I is identify your claim. So they're working a lot with arguments. So they want to know like what a claim is, and certainly these different ads do that. N is note the evidence. D is determine the framework and mindset. F is focus on the facts. U is understand the counterargument. And L is leverage your response. So they think if they can set readers and writers and thinkers up to do this on text that they encounter, and whether that's a written argument from the 18th century or a piece of media that was just produced by a Russian troll farm or something, then which is the whole idea of is really sort of funny to think about, but then it's really scary also. That they think that people will have sort of a framework to act on that, and I think that to some extent those kinds of things are really helpful. And certainly students who can evaluate evidence, we want that. We want students who can evaluate evidence critically and think about, you know, the funding sources behind different things, too. I think that's always an interesting part of all of this is like, well, who's funding this ad? Who's funding the spread of this ad? You know, if it's the Russian government, which, you know, I think there's, like I said, there's blame to go around. They probably are a little bit to blame here as we're finding out. But they're not wholly to blame. I mean, this is not a Russia problem. This is not a Trump problem. This is not a Hillary Clinton problem. This is not a school problem. This is not a society problem. This is all of us. We all are in the midst of this, and I think that all of us can do things and act in ways moving forward that can help to account for it. So at least all of us who want to fix things, want to make things better than they currently are. So, and I think acronyms like that can really help. But evaluating evidence, you know, that's an old idea, but it's certainly just as critical, more critical, I'd argue today, just to be sort of a civically minded participant in our democracy. I think that we've got to evaluate those things. And so that the chapter from Endicott, Jason Endicott here at the university, and doc students and John Broom, it was really their, you know, think before you click share. And so, you know, a lot of all of this news was spread by unsuspecting people who just didn't realize that what they were spreading wasn't true. I'd argue maybe most people who are on social media probably have and don't realize it. And so, you know, getting to the point where we are a lot more critical and really think about the act of sharing something is, you know, retweeting something, of sharing something on Facebook, et cetera. You really are putting your endorsement behind that. And if I'm sharing something, people will, you know, they will assume that I know what I'm talking about, or, you know, some people may assume that I don't know what I'm talking about, but whatever, they sort of associate that with me. And so I think if everybody sort of takes, maybe slows down just a little bit, you know, it's so easy to get wrapped up in media and Twitter feeds and all that sort of 24 hours news cycle, all that goes on. It's just, man, if we just slowed down a little bit, I feel like that would be just a good piece of advice that everybody could take, whether you're involved with schools or not. So.
Well, it sounds like the goal here is to equip students with the skills to live in the world, and it's just the world is changing, and so it's a new set of skills to consider, which is what teachers are supposed to do, right?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the case, but I also have to, you know, sort of caution us and say, you know, school right now is set up where I believe most teachers don't feel like they necessarily have the latitude to make some of those changes. You know, curricula are set. Sometimes they're purchased from people that have nothing to do with the local school system. You know, I think that teachers feel an enormous amount of pressure to sort of fall in line and do what's been done. And, you know, I think that we're trying to introduce critical media literacy and activities that would support, you know, thinking in these ways is more difficult in the context of schooling today, perhaps, than it's ever been. Because like I said, I think there's like this sort of, you know, boa constrictor snake around education in America, where we have standards and assessments and, you know, all of this negative publicity about school, and, you know, it's just continues to tighten and tighten and tighten. And so when you're in a situation like that, it's really difficult to sort of say, I want to bring something else in, because I think that most people would see that as a risk and see that as the potential, you know, to perhaps have people lose their jobs. And, you know, the idea of tenure of a teacher and that kind of thing has continued to erode in America in the last several years. And, you know, I do believe that teachers need some job protection, and I think that we need to trust our teachers to do what's best for the kids in our schools. And when we're back to that situation, you know, well, I'll be happy to entertain sort of ideas of accountability. But you can't have accountability without autonomy. And I believe autonomy has been under critical attack, the autonomy of teachers in our schools and of schools themselves.
Well, thank you so much for your time, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.
That was Chris Gehring, an associate professor of English education at the University of Arkansas, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda. Gehring is co-editor of the new book, Critical Media Literacy and Fake News in Post-Truth America. You can find out more at Brill.com.
KUAF is more than what you hear on the radio. The KUAF app lets you listen to our live stream, plus 24-hour classical music on KUAF2, and jazz and local music programs on KUAF3. You can find those streams at KUAF.com, and while you're there, you can find the Ozarks at Large and other local podcasts. All of these digital services are free for you, but they cost KUAF more money each year. Your gift ensures important programming is available to you anytime, anywhere. Support the programming you rely on by making a gift right now at supportkuaf.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. The National Weather Service is warning that conditions are ripe for the spread of fire through early evening tonight. Very dry and very windy conditions in northwest Arkansas and eastern Oklahoma have caused the agency to issue a red flag warning through 6 this evening. Afternoon humidity values between 15 and 25%, afternoon temperatures near 60, and winds of up to 50 miles per hour mean any fire is likely to spread rapidly. Arkansans with developmental disabilities will be the focus of a month-long campaign by the state's Department of Human Services. Melissa Stone with DHS says helping people with such disabilities get jobs is one of the key goals of the campaign.
We're seeing some stigmas here at DDS, particularly related to employment, which is one of our big focuses for 2018, is to assist clients with supported integrated employment, not just employment in a segregated type setting.
A poster emphasizing the campaign was released earlier today at the state capitol. Brooke Schultz, a diver with the University of Arkansas, will be heading to the NCAA Championships after finishing fourth at the NCAA Zone D Diving Championships in Minneapolis. The freshman and Fayetteville native will compete at the national championships in Indianapolis next week. Peyton Palsha, another freshman, has qualified for the Razorbacks in the 1650 freestyle. And the Walmart Amp is adding some metal to its summer lineup in Rogers. The venue announced yesterday a bill of Slayer, Lamb of God, Anthrax, Testament, and Napalm Death will turn it up to 11 on Monday, August 13th. Tickets, available through Walton Arts Center outlets, go on sale Friday morning at 10.
91.3 is supported by the Walmart Museum, a family-friendly experience featuring interactive displays on the history of Walmart, Walton's Five and Dime, and the Spark Cafe Soda Fountain. Located on the square in downtown Bentonville, it's open daily until 9 p.m. Admission is free. 273-1329 or WalmartMuseum.com. Make room for pie. A delicious slice of the natural state will premiere on the Arkansas Educational Television Network, AETN, Thursday, March 8th at 6:30 p.m. Author Kat Robinson takes viewers on a tour of old-time diners and off-the-beaten-path cafes in search of some of Arkansas's best pies. AETN.org for more.
Full theater life will be given to Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility Thursday night at 7, courtesy of Aquila Theater Company at Walton Arts Center. It's part of the venue's 10x10 series, meaning most tickets cost just $10. The mission of the New York-based enterprise Aquila Theater Company is to bring the greatest works to the greatest numbers. Every year, they send a pair of touring productions across the country. Yesterday afternoon, during a storm-induced power outage in New York City, we were still able to reach Desiree Sanchez, Executive Artistic Director of Aquila Theater Company. She says the founders of Aquila wanted to bust preconceptions of the classics and create a theater company for everybody.
And that these are really great works for a reason, and they shouldn't be seen by the select elite few. They should be seen by everybody. Everybody can gain something from them. And by sort of knocking them off their pedestals and dusting them off and recreating them and making them really alive and vivid, that they can have a new life for us today.
That's sort of the interesting challenge, because we all have, almost all of us have examples of something we discovered later in life, but we're either forced to read, you know, as teenagers or adolescents, that we thought, oh my goodness, this is boring. This doesn't relate to me at all. And then you see it later done with, you know, when you're not forced, when you see it done with care and an eye towards contemporary issues, you go, oh, I see.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And also sometimes it's just, it's never taught to us. In a way that is bringing forth what really matters about these works. And sometimes we're just pounded with understanding the language. And I remember having to read Shakespeare for the first time and going, oh, my God, I don't understand this. I just feel like I'm reading another language. And I just felt stupid, you know. And I think if I had a really great teacher, if I had somebody who really understood it, and if I knew more about the culture in which it was made, and I think I would have really, I would have had exposure to it much earlier in my life, and I would have loved it much earlier in my life.
It seems, I'm guessing, I might be wrong, but it seems like Sense and Sensibility and Jane Austen really relate to 2018 anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why these things are classics, and you know, because there's something about them that just really rings true to today. Yeah, I mean, on one hand, we've come a long way, and on the other hand, we're really, really in the same boat, more or less. So yeah, we still have people who don't get married because of money, who get married because of money. We still have people who feel trapped by their social upbringing. Yeah, I mean, it takes a different form than it did back then, but it's still there. It's still definitely very, very prevalent.
Those issues that she wrote about more than a century ago and can feel them now?
Well, I didn't have to do any writing, thank God, on this one. I was very fortunate in finding a really wonderful adaptation by a woman named Jessica Swale, who very much did that. And I think what I love about her translation is she really just brought it to life. The thing about Jane Austen is it's a novel, so it can be quite dense when you read it, and for some of us, it takes a while to get into. Other people love it. I mean, I would say the majority of people coming to see the show are huge Jane Austen fans, and I kind of didn't realize how many Jane Austen fans there quite are. I mean, wow, there's a lot. But I would say, having read it as a novel, the things that, and I don't actually know if it's because I've been working with British actors, and my husband's British, so I'm around that culture and the way they speak, and so maybe I got a sense of it more than maybe I would have when I was younger. She's an incredibly witty author, and she has these amazingly funny characters that are so, they literally jump off the page. So for me as a director, it was pretty easy to figure out, you know, how I was going to bring this to life and put them on the stage. And the adapter was great because she did a really wonderful, fast-moving play that just really gets the heart of the story, has a lot of that humor in it, and yet still has the heart of the story as well. And I think that's the brilliance of Jane Austen, is that she loves to poke fun and really show how ridiculous the class system was at that time, and how people were so absurd in the way they acted and put on airs. But at the end of the day, it's still a love story. So despite all of that happening around, you know, happening, there's still this incredible elemental story of love and sacrifice in it. And so whenever you have an author who can bring those two worlds together, like Shakespeare or Jane Austen, it's just fantastic.
You mentioned Shakespeare because Hamlet is the other production that Aquila has touring the country. Is there ever a conversation, perhaps maybe even a heated one, with you and your colleagues at Aquila, what exactly is a classic?
No, I think we're all we don't argue about what a classic is, although I wish very much so that we were able to present a wider array of works that we would consider classics that maybe other people wouldn't. So I think, you know, I think at the moment it's a very white European view of what a classic is that we're able to sort of sell to a broader audience. But I hope one day that I'll be able to tour things that are coming from completely different parts of the world, because there's some wonderful works out there, and I'd love to expand that canon. So it's always sort of a fine balance between what can book, you know, and what we want to show. And so, you know, we've had a couple of years where we've tested some things out and we've done okay. But it's, I have to say, it's really difficult because people are not brought up with titles outside the typical world of what they think is a classic.
Desiree Sanchez, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Desiree Sanchez is the executive artistic director of Aquila Theater Company. They'll bring a production of Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility to Walton Arts Center Thursday night, beginning at 7. It's part of the Walton Arts Center's 10 by 10 art series. You can learn more at waltonartcenter.org. In the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Pete Hartman, who is Operations Manager at 91.3. Welcome back.
Thank you. Hello.
Welcome to March.
I'll say daffodils.
And wind.
And especially wind.
What is this, Kansas today? We're up to 50 miles an hour this afternoon.
You know, and I don't know if, I'm sure I've seen, but that's, for a gusting wind throughout a day, that's pretty,
it's not what we're used to. Sunday special this week is something we're getting used to, discussion about Russia.
That's right. It's coming from the Embedded podcast. And while I'm not into a lot of podcasts, I have heard of this one. And it's a two-part special. It'll start this Sunday, finish up next Sunday. But it is on the Russian influence, or perceived or whatever, of the 2016 presidential campaign. This first hour, it says it covers the question of collusion, whether or not President Trump's campaign coordinated with Russia. Looks like we might get a good idea of really what's going on these two programs. So that's Sunday at 3 p.m. And then the second part will be the following Sunday, 3 p.m.
Anything happening between now and then in the area?
Oh, you bet there is. And these will be featured on the ComSpots community spotlights this week. Today and tomorrow, Northwest Arkansas Community College, their Spring Arts and Culture Festival. And it's interesting, while there will be art displays, they've really tied this festival into world culture, world art, and labor. So it's kind of an interesting thing going on. That's today and tomorrow. You got time to go up there. The West Fork Hope Fest is coming up this weekend, and we're going to hear from Amber Freeman later this week. Creator of the event, also a cancer survivor, and all proceeds benefit the American Cancer Society. She's got a kind of a cool story that we'll hear.
And I should mention, Community Spotlight heard every morning during Morning Edition at 6:30 and 8:30, and then throughout the rest of the day on 91.3.
That's true. Finally, Continuum of Care. They're meeting up March 9th. It's a group that's done some work with homelessness. They spent the past year gathering data They've got all these numbers to crunch now, and they're going to get kind of a community plan on how to fight this stuff. It's free. It takes place March 9th, and we'll hear more about that a little later this week. Now some things taking place really quickly, like today. Social activist Peyton Head, student body president of the University of Missouri back in 2015, when a lot of things were happening at the University of Missouri. Well, he's going to speak today on the campus. That's going to take place this evening, 6 p.m., Gerhardt Hall Auditorium. He helped ignite some protests that really shook up Missouri during that time, so that might be interesting. A public screening of the film Little Stones tonight at 6 p.m. That's in the Wingate Art and Design on the University of Arkansas Fort Smith campus. Little Stones, its award-winning documentary, weaves together the lives of four women around the world who use art to bring attention to domestic violence.
All right, Pete Hartman, operations manager at 91.3. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
With the Department of Arkansas Heritage, I'm Mark Chris of the Arkansas World War I Centennial Commemoration Committee. 100 years ago, on March 14, 1918, Herman Davis, a hunting guide from Mississippi County, was inducted into the U.S. Army in Blytheville. After training at Camp Pike, he sailed for France as part of Company I, 113th Infantry, 29th Division. His experience hunting ducks on Big Lake came in handy, and Davis was soon recognized as a deadly marksman as he wiped out machine gun nests and killed dozens of German soldiers. He once shot five enemy soldiers at a range of 1,000 yards, which he described as just good shooting distance. He would receive the U.S. Distinguished Service Cross and the French Croix de Guerre with Gilt Star and Medaille Militaire. His health failed after he returned to the States, in part because of exposure to poison gas. He died on January 5, 1923. The city of Manila donated land to memorialize Davis, and a life-size statue of him was erected there on Memorial Day 1925. The site is now Herman Davis State Park. To learn more, visit ww1arkansas.com.
A service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Alma. Ozarks at Large, a production of 91.3. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks for listening. Back tomorrow at noon and 7 with another brand new edition of our daily show. We will end today's show with music from John Dooley, recorded inside the Carver Center for Public Radio. John's going to be, well, practically everywhere in this week. Tonight, he's playing at JJ's on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. Tomorrow, JJ's Grill in Bella Vista. Thursday, Pinnacle Bar and Grill in Rogers. Friday, Pinnacle Country Club in Rogers. Saturday, Fred's Hickory Inn in Bentonville. That's just this week. He's all over the place later this month as well. You can see John Dooley's entire schedule and learn more about him and hear some of his music at his website, johndooley.com. That's J-O-N-D-O-O-L-Y.com. One of the hardest working men in music. Plus, one of his pictures on his website, he's wearing a Kansas City Royals hat, so we should probably support him. John Dooley, recorded inside the Carver Center for Public Radio, the song Burning Out. Thanks for listening. So I hope that burning bright ain't burning out. I hope that burning bright ain't burning out. Every line working hard turned to rhymes to rich. Red wine, callous hearts, and jealous fingers. Hope floats on a river of almost chance. Just a two steps on the working life's cans and cans. Well, I feel like I'm close to getting mine. Polish on a rock, trying to make it shine. Think I have it all figured out. So I hope that burning bright ain't burning out. Hope that burning bright ain't burning out. Turn it up, turn it off, and turn it down. Look up, life's gone before you turn around. How long can I shine without burning out? And I don't want to burn out. Well, I feel like I'm close, getting mine. Putting polish on a rock, trying to make it shine. Think I have it all figured out. So I hope that...
wanna burn out. I don't wanna burn out.